hospitals.
We call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for March 15th. We have a complicated agenda today. We have two major things going on at the same time. We have a overflow in the gallery. We won't allow any standing room here, but we still have some seats, I think. The intention is to allot 55 minutes, almost an hour, for the public hearing on Bill 3391, and that leave 45 minutes for the report to us from the Oregon Health Authority on Medicaid re-enrollment, another very important topic for us. We're going to try and organize the panels in a way that will alternate a for panel and against panel. We may not have time for everybody who signed up, so I'm going to ask you all to be as brief as you can to make room for other people, and we'll keep going until 4 o'clock. With this hearing, then we'll close the hearing. So please try and be considerate of other people who want to have a chance to testify. As I say, we'll alternate for and against panels. Administrator, will you tell us what the bill is, and then will you call the first panel, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3391 requires the health benefit plan coverage of specified health care services, drugs, devices, and products, and procedures relating to reproductive health. It allows exemption for plans sold to religious employers. It also requires the Oregon Health Authority to implement a program to reimburse the costs of services, drugs, devices, products, and procedures relating to reproductive health provided to the individuals who become pregnant and who would be eligible for medical assistance. It prohibits discrimination in the provision of health care coverage. It prohibits interference by a public body in consenting female choices to terminate a pregnancy. Mr. Chair, this declares an emergency as an effective on passage.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3391. Would you call the first panel, please?
The first panel is Dr. Xenia Junkier, Mariah Isabella Rodriguez, and Dr. James Newhall. And I apologize for mispronouncing the doctor's name.
Please identify yourself when you begin testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlight, co-chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Xenia Junkier, and I'm Director of Equity and Community Engagement for NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. I want to thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3391. I'm here on behalf of the Pro-Choice Coalition of Oregon, a broad coalition of gender and racial justice organizations, including ACLU, APANO, Family Forward, NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon, Oregon Latino Health Coalition, Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, and Western States. Our coalition exists because we know access to reproductive health care is critical for the health and economic security of all Oregonians. As it stands, the reproductive health care for hundreds of thousands of Oregonians is at stake. The Reproductive Health Equity Act, House Bill 3391, fixes this by establishing comprehensive coverage for the full spectrum of reproductive health services, including family planning, abortion, and postpartum care for all Oregonians, regardless of income, citizenship status, gender identity, or type of insurance. By requiring all insurance plans to abide by the ACA provisions that prohibit insurance companies from imposing cost sharing for preventive reproductive health care, this bill ensures that families in Oregon, regardless of income, are able to decide whether and when to become parents. This includes access to intrauterine contraceptives, the most expensive but most effective method of contraception. And it also includes access to vasectomy, one of the most preferred methods of contraception for women and their partners. Given the uncertainty of healthcare at the federal level, Oregon needs to take every precaution necessary to ensure reproductive healthcare and access to reproductive healthcare, by codifying a right to abortion in Oregon statute and by adding abortion onto the list of services that must be covered without cost sharing, HB 3391 continues Oregon's longstanding tradition of treating abortion as part of the full spectrum of reproductive health care that all Oregonians deserve. When we say all Oregonians, we mean all Oregonians. By establishing reproductive health coverage for those who are categorically excluded from OHP based on their citizenship status, this bill ensures that all women in Oregon have access to the health care they need to care for their children during the postpartum period, a critical time for mother and baby. Finally, by including the non-discrimination clause, HB 3391 prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity, ensuring that Oregonians are not denied access to life-saving cancer screenings and other reproductive health care services based on their gender marker. Thousands of Oregonians have already contacted their elected officials, urging them to sign on to House Bill 3391, because they know that restrictions on reproductive health care can have a profoundly harmful effect on public health, particularly for those who already face significant barriers to receiving high-quality care. Organizations such as the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, Fair Shot for All, Coalition of Local Health Officials, and the Northwest Health Foundation have endorsed the legislation because they know that all Oregonians need access to full reproductive health coverage for a stronger economy and for families to thrive. I thank you for your consideration of the Reproductive Health Equity Act, and I hope you will join me in supporting this important piece of legislation.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Maria Isabel Rodriguez, and I'm an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University and a practicing physician at OHSU's Center for Women's Health. Thank you for taking the time to hear from me today. OHSU supports House Bill 3391 because it brings Oregon closer to ensuring equitable access to health care for all Oregonians. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, a majority of Oregonians are now insured, an impressive 93%. However, I want to speak today about those that still remain uninsured and in need of coverage. An estimated 48,000 women of reproductive age live in Oregon, are categorically excluded from Medicaid, despite meeting the traditional financial eligibility requirements, simply because of their citizenship status. And they're also prohibited from using their own money to purchase insurance on Oregon's health care exchange. Comprehensive reproductive health care is fundamental to the health of women and their families, and failure to provide care has multi-generational consequences for their children. And it ultimately leads to significant health care costs for our society. Immigrant women have highly restricted access to reproductive health care. Due to finite funding, Title X is able to cover only a small percentage of the family planning services that are needed. Some women are able to access prenatal care when they're pregnant through Cowan Plus. However, that coverage ends the day that they give birth. As an obstetrician, I want to emphasize the critical importance of postpartum care for both maternal and newborn health. It's absolutely essential. This is when we screen and treat for postpartum mood disorders, it's when we help support breastfeeding, and it's when we offer women contraceptive choice. We simply can't care for children without caring for their mothers. Simple clinical problems, which are routinely managed in a physician's office, are diverted to the emergency room because of lack of coverage. For example, women who are experiencing miscarriage are unable to access a simple and safe outpatient surgical procedure. An extremely stressful and sad point in their life, we're not able to efficiently offer them the care that they need, but have to instead counsel them to wait for the pregnancy to spontaneously resolve, putting them at increased risk of both bleeding and infection, or we send them to the emergency room where we care for them at a much greater cost. Women also are unable to access important care postpartum. For example, even if they have a severe infection or a complication from a C-section, they aren't able to see their doctor for care but have to go to the emergency room. Research strongly supports the impact of publicly funded contraception as an intervention that both improves health outcomes as well as saves public funds. Providing women the choice of highly effective contraception in the immediate postpartum, such as with an IUD or implant, is an underutilized strategy to improve maternal and newborn health. Increasing access to postpartum contraception is recognized by both the American Congress of OBGYNs as well as the Center of Disease Control as a priority public health action. Women in Oregon covered under Cowan Plus currently do not have access to any postpartum care, including contraception. We've conducted research at OHSU that demonstrates that this is a missed opportunity to both improve health and actually save the state money. A cost-benefit analysis we conducted demonstrates that providing women the choice of an IUD or implant postpartum would actually save state Medicaid $3 for every dollar spent on such a program. Immigrants are our neighbors, our coworkers, our family, and our friends. OHSU supports the commitment to improving the health of all Oregonians by providing health insurance coverage regardless of citizenship status. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is James Newhall. I'm a practicing physician in Oregon for the past 34 years. Much of that time, I provided abortions at a clinic downtown. I'm here to advocate for widespread availability of affordable contraception. One of my goals in life, in my career, was to make abortion legal, safe, and rare, and we've accomplished two of those three objectives. The third objective, making it rare, it can only come through adequate access to contraceptive, all forms of contraception. Under current law, segments of our population are omitted, left out of availability, including people whose citizenship status is in question, people who are covered under so-called grandfathered insurance plans. And I would like to see these barriers removed, and I would like all women to have access to contraception. Another form of contraception, so-called Plan B or the morning after pill or emergency contraception, the FDA has recently made this legal, but there's still barriers. I mean, the pill is expensive, and people need to come to a physician in order to get a prescription in order to have it filled. And this seems like a really simple, relatively cheap way to make my workload lighter. So I would like very much I appreciate your consideration of these issues and hope that you can pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Russell.
Yeah. Thanks, Chair Greenlick. Question. Do men have reproductive health needs?
I'm sorry. Say again.
Do men have reproductive health needs?
Well, not in the same sense that women do, I guess, because women have the children. So men have, yes, it would be nice if men had ready access to vasectomies. Is that what you're referring to?
I mean, do they have reproductive health needs?
Well, infertility, but that's not really my area.
I would say that they do. They have a need for access to sexually transmitted infection screening and management. They might have need for infertility services. Like women, men want to choose if and when to become a parent, so they need access to contraception and education about how to prevent or have a healthy pregnancy when they decide to become a parent.
Screenings, assessment, counseling. So just in maybe prostate screening. So how come they're not included in this bill?
They are.
It says, well, women care, including screenings, assessment, and counseling. Why just women? Why aren't men included?
Well, I would have to look at the language of the bill, but I believe they are included in their different places.
Yeah. Representative Bueller and Chair Greenlake, they are included, and through our non-discrimination clause, we are not discriminating services based on gender identity, which means preventative services are available for men and for women, people who identify as men and identify as women.
Follow up?
Let's keep moving on. But wait, one more.
Thank you. I think we have a definitional problem in the bill. You should look at Section 2, Subsection 2A.
Representative Bueller, if you would like, I've got some colleagues here that can probably speak to the complexities and nuances of this bill. If you would like, we can call on them.
We'll get to it as we go on. Keep that question in mind. Okay. Thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Clarification. Representative Hack had her hand.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Chair, I just want a clarification. If we have questions as it relates to the components of the bill. Is that not for this panel? Are you going to have a panel here that can speak to the actual components of the bill?
I think we can speak to an awful few questions, and if they can't answer it, the next ones will be able to handle it. Why don't you put your questions on the table?
Okay. There's no exemption for business and nonprofits that are owned or directed by religious people. If they choose a health plan that does not cover abortion or contraception, if they have a religious objection.
Yes, Representative Hack, Chair Greenlick. The Reproductive Health Equity Act includes a religious exemption clause that allows insurers to offer religious employers, to offer plans, excuse me, to religious employers that exclude coverage for contraception or abortion. And again, I would offer that we have colleagues here who can speak to the nuances of that, who might be able to answer the question.
Can I follow up then? So they will be able to answer that directly, because I don't see an exemption in the bill.
They would be able to answer.
There'll be folks creating discussion on both sides of that question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your questions.
Thank you. Would you call the next panel, please?
Okay. Can we get a fourth chair? Jessica, this is a panel from the opposition. Jessica Adamson, Mike Cotton, Colm Willis, and Teresa Hark.
I'll be raising that issue directly.
They wanted to come at four, I asked.
All right.
Okay, sorry.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Cotton. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Providence Health Plans, and I'm here today to express our concerns in opposition to House Bill 3391 in its current form. Providence Health Plans provides managed health care services to more than 1 million individuals in the state of Oregon and approximately 642,000 insured and self-funded plan members in the state. We've been part of Oregon's health insurance market for over 30 years. We are one of only two statewide insurance carriers in the individual market, and our members comprise roughly half of that population. Our individual and small group and large group products serve over 260,000 Oregonians. Our commitment to compassionate service for all is strongly rooted in our mission. As a Catholic-sponsored organization, Providence Health Plans operates under the ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare services, which emphasizes respect for the sanctity of life and provides clear instruction that we are not permitted as an organization to provide or cooperate with the provision of abortion services. As currently written, House Bill 3391 would require all health plans to include abortion services in their benefit package. This requirement would violate the ethical and religious directives, and for us, it's simply a red line that we cannot cross. As written, the abortion mandate in this bill would not allow Providence to file forms or even serve Oregonians in the insurance market. We believe a simple remedy to this is to create a narrowly crafted statutory conscience clause that would enable any health plan sponsored by religious organizations to not violate its religious tenets. It is essential for Providence to have certainty on this particular issue. There are many parts of this bill that we certainly support, especially those that are expanding the Cowan program and the coverage requirements for preventive care services and contraceptive services. Moreover, we are not here to ask you to put this bill away or in a drawer. Instead, we're asking for your help in correcting the serious issues that puts us at risk and our ability to continue to serve Oregonians throughout the state. We appreciate the discussions we've had over the past several months with proponents of this bill. Unfortunately, we have not been able to reach a mutually satisfactory agreement on how it would be constructed. We are willing to continue these conversations and look forward to the opportunity to do that, to drive to a consensus path forward. Thank you for your opportunity to share this the serious consequences to the lives of Oregonians that we serve, our rural communities, and the overall insurance marketplace if this bill is passed as written.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, member, for the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services. And I won't repeat what we've already heard from our CEO, but I do want to take the opportunity to share with the committee some of what we have been talking about internally in terms of, or with the proponents and the advocates, as well as with many of you, about what a narrowly tailored statutory conscience clause might look like. What we're interested in is a clause that would allow religiously sponsored insurers that have historically had an objection to providing such services and continue to have an objection to be able to exercise that conscience clause. Our discussions have been very productive and cordial with the proponents, and we appreciate that. But what we have heard and what we want to put on the record today is that Section 2, Subsection 10, which is on page 3, lines 39 through 42 of the bill, should provide sufficient coverage for Providence. We want to be clear on the record that that unfortunately does not provide us the certainty that Providence needs in order to be able to operate in this market. The provision is creates the opportunity for DCPS to grant an exemption if the bill would violate federal funds through its enforcement. However, it does not require DCBS to do so. It allows them to, but does not require them to do so if the conclusion is made that it may. The bill specifically provides that they may do that as opposed to a shall. In addition, the subjective nature of this provision is driven in part by there's no clear criteria by which they would make that decision. It simply says if they can determine that, then they may provide an exemption. That for Providence means that we could be year by year, administration by administration, either at the federal or at the state level. How folks view this, reasonable people can disagree as to whether and under what circumstances federal funds might be at risk. Again, we are not here to fundamentally oppose portions of this bill. There are things that, in a standalone way, particularly the CALM expansion, we supported CALM coming into Oregon in the first place several years ago, and very proud of what that's meant for Oregonians. And we want to continue that work and support that portion of this bill in particular. But we need to fix this in order to ensure that the 260,000 Oregonians who rely on us as an insurance carrier, when we get to the end of all of this, are not put at risk. And we look forward to making that happen and working cooperatively to get there, and ask for your help in helping to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of this committee. My name is Cullen Willis, and I'm here at the request of Oregon Right to Life to ask you to oppose House Bill 3391. House Bill 3391, as written, would force all health benefit plans offered in this state to cover abortion. And this mandate violates the rights of pro-life Oregonians, especially the rights of people who offer health benefit plans in our state. Oregonians deserve to be free from government coercion that would force us to violate our deeply held belief that every human person has value. Here in Oregon, we live with many people who are different than us, and that's part of what makes this a great place to live. And one of our fundamental values as Oregonians is tolerance for people who are different than us. This bill would violate that principle in a profound way. Moreover, at a time when public dollars are tight, this bill would put Oregon's federal funding in jeopardy. The Weldon Amendment, which is a piece of federal law that's been included in every labor and health and human services appropriations budget since 2004, specifically prohibits what House Bill 3391 would do. The Weldon Amendment states that none of the funds made available in this act may be made available to a state or local government if such government subjects any institutional or individual healthcare entity to discrimination on the basis that the healthcare entity does not provide coverage for abortions. Further, the law defines the term healthcare entity to specifically include a health insurance plan. The Weldon Amendment is enforceable by the Department of Health and Human Services, and the penalty for violating the Weldon Amendment could be the loss of federal funds. Just this month, the majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives wrote a letter to newly appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, specifically asking him to review the Weldon Amendment and ensure that states are complying with its terms. If this bill passes, it could have a significant detrimental impact on the federal aid that so many Oregon programs rely upon. In short, this bill violates our common value of tolerance, it violates the deeply held beliefs of pro-life Oregonians, and it violates the federal law. We ask that you oppose House Bill 3391. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Teresa Harkey, and I'm with the Oregon Family Council. I'm here today in opposition of House Bill 3391. We see House Bill 3391 as a sweeping assault on religious freedom by requiring Oregon health insurance policies to provide abortion coverage. Many Oregonians have a moral and religious opposition to abortion, and this bill would require them to violate their conscience and participate in abortion coverage. Our legal analysis, which I have attached for you by Attorney Sean Lindsay, shows that this bill ultimately fails in any attempts to protect our religious freedom rights. The religious exemption only applies to nonprofit religious employers. It leaves individuals of faith, unincorporated associations, and religious owners of for-profit entities in conflict. Individuals and organizations not included in the exemption find themselves in a cruel predicament. They must either violate their conscience or violate the law. Furthermore, House Bill 3391 does not provide religious employers any specified access that do not cover abortion to plans that do not cover abortion and contraceptives, which is a problem, leaving even those exempted to the whims of state insurers as to whether or not they can even find such a plan. It also requires a religious employer to notify all employees of the abortion and contraceptive coverage that they will not be providing. This makes the current exemption appear antagonistic to religious organizations and persons. A bill requiring all insurers to cover abortion leaves it vulnerable to court challenges as well on basis of constitutionality. There have been several recent Supreme Court cases cited in our legal analysis that upheld that government should accommodate religious beliefs and that individuals do not lose their religious freedom when they open a family business. Our attorney also noted that House Bill 3391 does not comply with U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and consequently it is at high risk of being struck down as unconstitutional. We strongly urge you to vote no on House Bill 3391 and to protect religious freedoms of all Oregonians of conscience. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a question for our insurance carriers and a statement, but a question within the statement. The Weldon Amendment is concerning, and so on February 28th, I, as Vice Chair of Healthcare, put a request into our legislative council to tell me, so I could advise my members here, whether the Weldon Amendment would put our 1115 waiver or other federal funds at risk. That's been 16 days ago. We again reiterated that request about 4 days ago, and they say you don't need to ask for this twice. You've already asked for it on February 28th. I said, well, then please answer. Today, they have still not had time to answer that question. So I'm left with asking you, who runs insurance companies, if we did this law as passed, as written, do you feel that there is a legitimate risk to our federal funding because it violates the Weldon Amendment and doesn't allow for the religious exemptions that we have? Are we putting $10.7 billion at risk in our health system in Oregon to make a point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we are not legislative counsel. It is difficult for us to even attempt to pretend to be in their shoes. So what I will tell you—
Apparently they're busy.
appreciate that. However, what I would say is the Weldon Amendment is an amendment that is attached to the Health and Human Services, Labor and Education Appropriations Bills. That amendment is readopted every year as part of that process. And it the penalty for the violation of it, and it applies to healthcare providers and insurers. It says that you can't require them to pay for, perform, provide coverage of, or refer for abortion services, and you can't discriminate at the federal, state, or local level against providers or insurance for insurers for refusing to do so, for exercising their own beliefs. If you do, then all labor, health and human services, and education funding may be withheld, would be withheld from the state if it's enforced. We, as a Catholic Healthcare Association member, have kept our eye on this amendment for some time. It has not been enforced ever, but that, again, that is an administration-to-administration decision as to what they would choose or choose not to do in this case. So we can't speak to whether or not it would happen or under what circumstances. And for Providence, again, knowing that there is a range of what puts federal funds adversely at risk. Is it the existence alone of the Weldon Amendment, or is it someone from the federal government at our door saying we're withholding funds tomorrow? We don't. That is, reasonable people can disagree on that. That's our concern.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to go back to one of my original questions that I'm hoping you'll be able to answer, and that's as it relates to business or nonprofits that are ran by or owned by religious folks. It looks to me as though the exemptions are extremely narrow. You've pretty much got to be a church or it doesn't apply. Am I off there, or what is your opinion of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, again, not legislative counsel, but what we can say is our reading of the definitions is that the exemption would apply very narrowly to those employers. That though we are sponsored by a religious organization, a Catholic healthcare, it would not, the provision in this bill would not provide us an exemption to exercise our ethical and religious directives, not to provide insurance plans that do not cover abortion services. So we would
have to
under this bill.
So I guess it's a bit of a statement, but so essentially you would be forced to perform regardless of religious beliefs or regardless of whether or not you had someone that ran.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Hack, Providence as an employer has a self-funded plan. The provisions of this bill, because of the ERISA, federal ERISA statutes, would not apply to employers with self-funded plans. So we as an employer to our over 20,000 caregivers in Oregon would not be required to provide this coverage, nor would any of our providers be required to perform these services. However, Providence is a Catholic institution, health plan, the Providence Health Plan, we would not have a clear exemption. We would not be able to guarantee that the ability to practice our ethical and religious directives. And as this bill is written today, we would be forced to include abortion coverage as part of the health benefit plan, and that is something we cannot do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you call the next panel, please?
Okay. Michael Kahana, Christy Split, and Gloria Pinzon. We can scoot that.
You go ahead. Okay. Chair and committee members, is it okay if I go first? My name is Gloria. And so, okay. Thank you for listening to me today. My name is Gloria Maria Maldonado, and I'm a community development major at Portland State University. I'm a student there, and I've lived in Oregon for 20 years. I actively advocate for women's leadership through Las Mujeres PSU and as an alumna of New Leadership Oregon. I've also had the privilege of being a youth education advocate with Momentum Alliance. I'm here today because I believe healthcare is a necessary human right for all, not a privilege for a few. And I want to share my experience accessing healthcare as a teen mother. 12 years ago, I became a parent while I was under the care of my very low-income single mother. I was 17 years old. My mother could not access health care insurance for me. Fortunately, I was covered by CAWM. Through this coverage, I was able to get treated during my pregnancy to address my anemia and make sure my baby was healthy. After giving birth to my daughter, I went home from the hospital thinking everything was normal. And 3 days later, I was rushed to the emergency room due to heavy hemorrhaging. I was terrified, and I was seriously afraid I would not be able to raise my daughter. If I had not had access to health care and medication to stop the bleeding then, I don't know what would have happened to me or my baby. And what I think is that we can try to be careful and follow doctor's orders and try to be informed, but none of us can predict what healthcare needs we're going to have. That's why I think postpartum care is imperative for everyone. Mothers who give birth, regardless of citizenship status, deserve to have access to reproductive health care services. A mother's care does not and should not end when the child is delivered. We know that the health of a mother is important for the health of their children, and I believe that Oregonians, regardless of income, citizenship status, gender identity, or type of insurance, need to have access to a full range of reproductive health services, including postpartum care. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3391 today and taking our testimony. For the record, my name is Christy Splitt. Many of you know me. I spent a decade until last year working in this building and worked with most of you. About a month ago, when I was 12 weeks pregnant, we got bad news. Our unborn baby had tested positive for trisomy 13 in a routine screening test for moms over 35. The diagnosis was confirmed a week later. I haven't cried in a while. I'm gonna get past this, hold on. Trisomy 13 is a very rare and very severe chromosomal anomaly, an extra 13th chromosome on every cell affecting every organ in the body and causing catastrophic health outcomes. Most babies don't make it to their birthdays. Those that do have a median life expectancy of 12 and a half days. We have a 2.5-year-old daughter turning 3 right around the due date. Her first memory could have been the death of her sibling. We could not do that to her. The day after our diagnosis, I was able, really lucky enough, in Oregon, to have a first trimester abortion. We were grateful to be treated with candor, compassion, and respect by every healthcare provider we encountered. But that's not why I'm here. The afternoon after our diagnosis, we got a phone call from the clinic. They had talked to my insurance company, shared our story, and figured out the range of costs for our care. We had to bring $1,500 with us the next morning. $1,500. We were also told that that was just a deposit, and another bill would follow after insurance paid their share, anywhere up to $2,000 more. Out of our pockets. I dread going to the mailbox every day. We know more bills are yet to come, and we don't know what the final cost to us will be. We still haven't paid for the screening test, the diagnostic test, the ultrasounds, the specialists we had to see. I felt obligated to speak to this bill since we heard about the $1,500 deposit. Not for me, but for families that don't have our privilege. Forced to carry a baby, knowing the baby wouldn't make it, their sweet toddlers cozying up to growing pregnant bellies. And then having a hospital delivery costing tens of thousands of dollars to the system, neonatal care costing hundreds of thousands for mere days of life. All of that versus the relatively small amount of an early termination like we had. It makes no sense to the system or to people in our position. For us, we'll lose most of our savings. If we are blessed with another pregnancy, which we very much want, we will use credit cards, loans from our parents to pay my medical bills. And we are the lucky ones. Thank you for hearing our story. I've really practiced a lot and never cried and didn't make it, so I'm sorry. But I'm really happy to take any questions here or offline. I really am doing well with this. It just turns out it's a lot of pressure to testify before the committee. So thank you very much.
Chrissy, I want to clarify something.
Yes, sir.
Is it safe to assume that your problem with those high bills comes about even though you're covered by the state employee health insurance program?
I am covered by an insurance program here in the state of Oregon. My employer pays about $50,000 a year to employ the insure the 10 employees on our staff, including myself.
Okay. Rabbi Kohana, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. I'd like to take a minute or less of my testimony.
Please introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Rabbi Michael Kohana, Senior Rabbi of Congregation Beth Israel in Portland, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. If I may, I'd just like to take a moment to sit with the story we just heard, my testimony. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. I'm here testifying in support of HB 3391 because as a religious leader, I believe that access to reproductive health care is a moral right. Many religious groups have called for making reproductive care affordable and available. For centuries, Jewish legal authorities have acknowledged how essential reproductive choice is for the health and well-being of women and families. Across all branches of Judaism, in many situations, rabbis have made a place for birth control in family life and deeply appreciate this religious liberty. Judaism is not unique in this perspective. From the earliest days of the family planning movement in the United States, many religious leaders have embraced family planning as a moral good. I and leaders from a whole spectrum of religious denominations stand with them. Many of us who are parents ourselves are grateful to enjoy the sacred blessing of children. Our faith also sees how human beings have been graced by God with the ability to be intimate in ways separate and apart from childbearing. Access to safe and effective reproductive health care enables us to build strong bonds of partnership, serving the well-being of family life in our communities. Everyone deserves this moral agency. God, we believe, gave us the responsibility to make decisions when it comes to the most private aspects of our personal and family lives. Charting the course of life is a holy act. When we are able to receive reliable preventative medical attention, such as access to contraception, we strengthen family life. I urge you to join me in support of the Reproductive Health Equality Act, to affirm the sanctity of human life and to take these next crucial steps in providing comprehensive reproductive health care for everyone here in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Kenner
has a question. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the split, I just want to thank you for sharing a very difficult story.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thank you.
Call the next panel, please.
Caden Miller, Daniel Morris, and Michael Morrison. That's it. Well, if we have time.
Any one of you, start off.
Hi, my name is Caden Merrill. I live in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of Western States and HB 3391. Chairman Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm writing to ask you to support HB 3391, the Reproductive Health Equity Act. Access to reproductive health care is critical to health and economic security for all Oregonians. The Reproductive Health Equity Act establishes coverage for a full spectrum of reproductive health services regardless of income, citizenship status, gender identity, and type of insurance. While Oregon is on the forefront of LGBTQ equality nationally, thanks to the great work of this legislator, transgender Oregonians remain among our most vulnerable and misunderstood community members, particularly when it comes to accessing health care. For those unfamiliar, transgender is the term to describe a person whose gender is not the same as the sex they were born or assigned at birth. I am a transgender man. Like many of my peers, I still have a uterus, which means I need to get annual pap smear screenings. When I moved here 5 years ago, I established a relationship with my primary care provider in Hillsboro. Despite my repeated requests, my doctor told me I didn't need pap screening in my early 20s, contrary to standards of care for a person my age. I continue to ask. After 3 years, my doctor acknowledged she did not know how to treat me and recommended I find a new doctor. 2 years ago, I finally received the pap screening, which is critical to preventing cervical cancer. It came back positive for precancerous cells. To prevent the spread of cancer, my physician recommended a hysterectomy, which I was prepared for, but was denied this care because my mom's insurance provider denied treatment. The insurance company did not have a code that would allow a transgender man to have a hysterectomy. In January, my mother changed jobs and now we have new insurance, so I started the process again. Fortunately, I have a more knowledgeable doctor who's well-served, well-versed in serving transgender people. A recent pap screening has revealed that my cancer cells have spread, making my need for a hysterectomy even more acute. It's been 2 months, and I'm still currently working with my health insurance provider to approve the procedure so the precancerous cells can be removed. Sadly, my story is not unique. Transgender men like me face this kind of healthcare discrimination all the time, including in Oregon. You can change that by passing the HB 3391, the Reproductive Health Equity Act. Thank you for letting me share my story.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3391. I'm a doctor of public health. I have a background in doing research in maternal and child health epidemiology. I used to work as an epidemiologist for the Oregon Health Authority, mostly in chronic disease epidemiology and prevention. And I just want to talk today, just briefly, about some of the cost savings we could expect from this bill. I expect, and more details of this are in my written testimony, which I hope that you'll have an opportunity to read. But basically, I expect that in the next biennium, 3391 would save between $22 and $44 million. Most of those savings are actually for the state. A share are for the federal. A share of those savings are federal dollars, but most of them are from our state dollars, between about $13 to $27 million. Those savings result from preventing unintended pregnancies through the provision of effective contraception and counseling. I estimate that somewhere in the neighborhood of up to 3,500 unintended pregnancies would be prevented during the next biennium as a result of this bill. That would mean potentially over 1,000 fewer abortions. It would mean 1 to 2,000 fewer deliveries. And those are expenses that would be otherwise covered by the state. There are, of course, other, once those new Oregonians would show up, then they would be on the health plan, and those would be the federal costs, and that's where the federal savings would come in. But I will say that I think that those estimates are actually conservative because they don't account for all the other kind of health benefits and cost savings resulting from other components of reproductive health care that happen at those visits, including the screening for tobacco, alcohol and drug abuse, infectious diseases, domestic violence, cancer screening, and so forth. So I think that it's actually in the long run, we'd see really significant cost savings as a result of this bill. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you and urge your support in this important legislation. Thank you.
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Mike Morrison. I'm here on behalf of Service Employees International Union, Local 49. SEIU represents 65,000 workers across Oregon, many of whom work in various healthcare settings, including home care workers, hospital workers, and our Planned Parenthood clinics in the state. I'm here because I believe reproductive health care is not just a woman's issue, but an issue that affects all of us. I'm a husband and a father. I have twin girls who are 2 years old. And my wife Shannon is currently pregnant, expecting another child in May. I want to ensure that every family has access to the full spectrum of reproductive health services that they need. Following the birth of our daughters, our family had access to a variety of birth control provided through our insurance at no cost. This gave us the opportunity to learn how to care for two kids, to balance work and child care, and to ultimately decide to continue to grow our family when it made sense for us. Access to affordable reproductive health care should be available to everyone in the state of Oregon. And it impacts me personally. I believe it is crucial to provide Oregon men with the resources to take a more active, supportive role in family planning, to better ensure that their contraceptive needs and those of their partners are being met. Making decisions, initiating conversations about, and proactively practicing family planning and disease prevention are among the most important things that men can do to prioritize their sexual health and to participate with their partners in planning for the families that we want. We need to empower men to take control of their family planning, reproductive health needs, which includes offering coverage and vasectomy services, which this bill ensures. As a representative of SEIU, I know that across our state, our working families are facing real threats. Attacks on access to health care, a shortage of good-paying jobs, and housing crisis unlike any that we've seen before. And females disproportionately compromise the majority of the low-income health workers that we represent. Their caregiver is never sent to the ward. They care for people in the workplace. They care for people in their homes. And access to the full range of reproductive health care is the number one factor that determines a woman's financial fate. We at our union work hard to provide all of our members and their families with access to that better future. And that means providing them with the access to the full range of reproductive health care so that they can determine when to start a family or not. Working families are under tremendous financial hardships and have a hard time making ends meet. Families in Oregon need support like paid time off from work to care for loved ones and access to affordable child care. In this list of family supports, it's also critical that they have access to affordable, essential reproductive health care, which HB 3391 guarantees. In my position with Local 49, I work closely with the SEIU members who work at both the Legacy Emanuel and Legacy Good Samaritan hospitals in Portland. And despite working in the healthcare industry, the benefits offered to our members, healthcare workers, often include high deductible insurance plans with high cost share and out-of-pocket maximums, which means that members of our own union who work in our own hospitals in Portland struggle with the cost of healthcare for themselves and their families every day. And high cost share, high deductible health plans are a problem in general, but it's especially dangerous when we're talking about the need for reproductive health coverage. When private insurance companies charge unnecessary co-pays and deductibles for reproductive health services, they're keeping Oregonians from basic preventative health services. And you can end it here in Oregon by passing this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
We have one more witness who can talk to the religious exemption. I'd like to call that witness up.
Kimberly McCullough from ACLU.
Then we've had... Will there be any questions of this group? Okay. You guys are done. Thank you. We've gotten all the panels in.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I just wanted to clarify a few things in regards to the questions that happened before about religious exemptions and dispel, I think, two sort of myths that I heard. One was that this is going to put our federal funding at risk, and the other is that it's going to force Providence to do things that they don't want to do. And I don't believe that either of those things is true. When we crafted this bill, we were very careful to include actually two provisions that relate to potential religious exemptions. The first is subsection 2.9, and that section relates to religious employers. So there is an exemption. There is an explicit exemption for religious employers. That section uses the definition of religious employer that exists in ORS 743A.066. That is a definition of religious employer that already existed in Oregon law as it related to our contraceptive coverage provisions. And so there is an exemption there for religious employers. The second section is it's section 2 sub 10, and that relates to the section that says, basically what it says is that DCBS can grant an exemption, so Providence could apply for and DCBS could grant an exemption if our receipt of federal funds is maybe adversely affected. And so the way the mechanics of the way that would work is that Providence could apply
apply for that exemption, and DCBS would then look at the Weldon Amendment and determine if that applies, and if there is a risk of federal funding being pulled, then DCBS could then grant that exemption, and then the federal funds would not be pulled. So the idea that somehow DCBS is not going to grant that exemption and we're going to lose federal funds doesn't really make sense, because if DCBS were to determine that those federal funds may go away, then they would go ahead and grant that exemption. Now, it was mentioned that the Weldon Amendment may go away at some point, and I don't think it would be any surprise to you folks that we at the ACLU of Oregon would like to see the Weldon Amendment go away. If that were to happen, I'd like to suggest that Providence would not be without options. Oregon is not the first state to consider this issue, and the state of New York actually has already considered this issue and required coverage of abortions by insurers, but our understanding is that there are religious insurers in New York that what they have done is they've actually contracted with a third party to provide that coverage. So the insurance company doesn't pay for the abortion itself. And the key for that happening, that certainly is something that the state could say satisfies this provision if say, for example, the Weldon Amendment went away. The key there would just be making sure that that coverage is seamless for the insured, right, so that it's not overcomplicated and overly burdensome for them to be able to navigate. But there certainly is that option for Providence.
Providence does that now in terms of the PEBM
right.
coverage. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for your opinion. Would you say that your opinion on the Weldon Amendment is a unbiased opinion?
Is an unbiased
as
opinion?
As unbiased as yours.
I mean, I
I didn't write the bill.
Chair Greenlink and Representative Hayden, I will defer to the wisdom of the chair here on the answer there. I would say that certainly we all have our subjective views, but I am an attorney, and I do work with legal experts at our national organization, and we did very carefully craft this to make sure that it complies with federal law, and we do believe that if DCBS were to determine that the Weldon Amendment applies here, then they can go ahead and grant that exemption.
I would certify that she has an unbiased opinion, which I define as opinions that agree with mine.
I would agree with that.
Thank you, Chair. So I just have a thank you for stepping up. I have a couple just clarifications. When you... I think you're getting back to my question on the religious exemption piece. When I look up the ORS that is cited in the bill, again, it goes back to my concerns about it being very narrowly scoped. It says a religious employer is exempt from the requirements of this section with respect to a prescription drug benefit program, so on and so forth. It says a religious employer is an employer whose purpose is the
inculcation,
religious
I think.
Values. So basically, you have to have religious values. Their primary employees are persons who share the same religious tenets of the employer, and that primarily serves persons who share that religious tenets of the employer. So you're pretty much saying a church, and that's it.
Representative Hacken, Chair Greenlech, certainly a church would fit within that, and I think that there may be some other entities that I'm not thinking of that are not specifically called a church, but that would fit it within that. You are correct that is very, very narrow. I would argue that narrowness is appropriate. I think there is a difference between a religious employer where the purpose of the entity is to be promoting religious values, and a company that just happens to have maybe an executive at the top that has their own individual religious values. We don't believe that just because a boss has a certain set of religious values that boss should be interfering with the reproductive choices of their employees. And I suspect we may disagree about that.
I have a follow-up, Chair.
Yeah, let's be brief now.
Okay, so
Representative Hayden also has a follow-up.
So what you're saying is that if I own a business and I have a religious belief, that I can't choose a health care plan that doesn't include abortions?
Representative Hack, Chair Greenlick, certainly our view is that the price of doing business in the state of Oregon and running a business that is a non-religious business would be that you comply with laws that are applicable to business. And one of those laws is that you provide insurance coverage for your employees. And we would see a boss who owns a company that is not that entity doesn't have to do with a promotion of religious values, that them thinking that they can choose, pick and choose plans for their employees that do and don't cover things that the boss believes that the employee should or shouldn't do, that isn't an interference with the employee's right to receive health coverage and make their own health care decisions, the decisions that should be made between them and their doctor.
So I have one more question.
One more.
Thank you, Chair. So are you aware of the 2014 case, Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, SCOTUS?
Representative Hack and Chair Greenlick, yes, I am, and that has to do with the Federal Religious Freedom Act, the RFRA, and we do not have a RFRA here in Oregon, and so Hobby Lobby does not apply, and this bill would be constitutional under Hobby Lobby.
So you're going to provide a legal opinion on record saying that it would not violate a constitutional, that this would not be deemed unconstitutional on those grounds?
Representative Hack and Chair Greenlick, yes, it is my legal opinion that Hobby Lobby would not invalidate this because Hobby Lobby was interpreting a federal law that does not apply here. And I would be happy to follow up with you if you would like.
That would be good if you would.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there a camera? Representative Hayden.
Me first, then. Okay, thank you. So when you discuss the narrowness, then you would concur with the Providence analysis that they would not receive an exemption.
Representative Kennemer, can you please repeat your question? I didn't quite
hear. Yes, I'm sorry. You discussed the narrowness of that exemption, which we were just, the religious exemption that we were just discussing. And it seems to me then that you would concur with Providence's analysis that they, as an organization, would not be covered by that narrow an exemption.
Representative Kennemer, excuse me, and Chair Greenlick, there are actually two separate provisions that we're talking about. The one that Representative Hack was bringing up is 2 sub 9, and that relates to religious employers.
Yes.
2 sub 10 relates to religious insurers. And so 2 sub 10, what it does is it says that if under federal law we would potentially risk funds, then DCBS can grant an exemption to insurers. And that federal law is not the same as the religious employer thing that is narrow. Federal law says that under the Weldon Amendment, it says that states can't discriminate against a healthcare entity on the basis that healthcare entity doesn't provide coverage for abortions. And those are separate provisions.
I think Representative Kennedy was asking the question with Providence as of an employer, Providence Health. Yes.
Right. Oh, excuse me. So for their own
church,
for their own employees.
Yeah, because they were religiously doctrine organization, but not a church.
Right. Representative Kennemer and Chair Greenlick, if you would mind, I would refrain from answering that question because I don't actually know all of the details about Providence and all of their subsets and who they employ. If you're talking about like Providence as a healthcare insurer and the employees that work there, like the people that are their claims adjusters,
no, the question
a Catholic organization.
Is, you said that an employer that was a church would be. Exempt. The question is,
right.
Would an employer like Providence that operates under the Catholic Church but isn't the church, would they be eligible for that same exemption?
For the religious employer exemption. So my understanding is that they are not, that there are multiple religious, that there are multiple Providence entities and that Providence, the insurer, is not a religious entity.
They're a Catholic entity.
Let's
go ahead and take this on.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question.
Thank you.
Can we get one follow-up?
Yep, one follow-up.
Okay, one follow-up. Very, very quickly, it's amazing who's watching. Legislative opinion miraculously showed up on my email while we were discussing here. The question was brought on the Weldon Amendment. Is it possible that the Secretary of Health and Human Services could withhold federal funds? They say the short answer is that it is not impossible, but it is unlikely. Would you say that the current administration that we have now has done anything else that is unlikely?
I would agree with you that they are sometimes unpredictable. But my point is that if DCBS grants an exemption,
despite the language that you have that has been put into section 2, subsection 11, that you have described as that exemption. Elsie is just saying, despite that language, it is still possible.
I think the possibility there would be that if DCBS for some reason did not grant an exemption and then the federal government disagreed with DCBS, I think DCBS could then change their opinion, right? They could say, oh, okay, now the federal government has told us they disagree with us, right? So I just don't see how that would actually play out, that our funds would ever actually get.
We're having a lot of fun with this.
Get pulled.
I'm going to close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On House Bill 3391. Thank you very much, and we'll take a moment to let the audience, if they want to escape. And then we're going to hear from the Oregon Health Authority on the problems of getting people enrolled.
Didn't you say this was going to be an entertaining presentation?
That are contrary.
I forgot.
If the insurer notifies him,
stand at ease for a moment. Can I ask the folks that are leaving to please clear the room?
Always informative.
As it refers back to churches only.
Religious employer. She read some definition and it must be.
We're back to order. I'll open an informational hearing and talk about the re-enrollment process for the Oregon Health Plan members in Oregon. And look forward to your... I'm going to ask the committee to hold the questions as we go through the presentation. The clarifying questions, if you want to ask important clarifications, then please do. If not, I hope we'll have some time at the end to discuss with them what's going on.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Beth Van Darby. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Health Authority, the Executive Director of the External Relations Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm taking her job.
I was going to announce it.
Too fast.
Wow.
Lynn, give her the baton.
and all the glory, I'm sure. We're here today to talk about the impact of retroactivity on Medicaid enrollment. We've had lots of questions from the legislature, and we have taken a great deal of time wanting to study this issue and make sure that we had a inkling and, you know, some clear information that we could share with you. Doesn't mean we have all the answers, and we're going to share what our lingering questions are at the end, and that's part of the reason why we appreciate your allowing our director of analytics, John Collins, to get through the presentation, and I'm happy to answer clarifying questions because he does want you to understand the slides as we go through.
It'll be about 30 minutes.
We'll go as quickly as makes sense. Absolutely.
Yep. So, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is John Collins. I am the director of the Office of Health Analytics under the Health Policy and Analytics Division for the Oregon Health Authority. And as Beth Ann just mentioned, we have been spending quite a bit of time looking through this issue. A lot of the time that we've done this has been in different pieces and different meetings and so on, and we spent some time over the past couple of weeks where we really put a concentrated effort and brought together a lot of the different pieces of data and understanding of the policies and procedures associated with eligibility and enrollment in CCOs, and really brought a lot of that information together. The majority of this talk is really going to concentrate on two of the main issues that have really come up over and over again amongst various stakeholders, the CCOs, members of the legislature. It's really around the issue of what's been going on with the overall Medicaid population. Why has it been dropping over the past several months, really since about March of 2016? And the other main issue that I'm going to be addressing is, while that's been dropping over time, we've also been seeing a change in the proportion of people who are enrolled in a CCO versus those that are open card or fee for service. Those two issues do have some connection with each other. The first issue is a little bit easier to explain. The second issue, I have to go through several different slides to point to the different elements of the story. But ultimately, it kind of comes down to a fairly parsimonious explanation as well. So the first slide here is just an overview of really that first issue. This shows a time frame from May of 2015 through September of 2016. And you can see really the point that I want you to look at here is roughly the point that's above the March of 2016. Prior to March of 2016, there were some fluctuations in those prior months related to the overall number of people who were on Medicaid. But since 2016, we've been seeing a pretty steady decrease. And even if you go past the September time that's here in this chart, you continue to see that decrease. A lot of that has to do with the, and this is the more simple explanation, a lot of it has to do with the fact that in March, or actually a couple months prior to March of 2016, we really started to enforce and move forward with our redetermination process for eligibles. Prior to that time, we had asked for and received from the feds a number of different pauses to the redetermination process. So all of the individuals that really came on to Medicaid and under the expansion in January of 2014, a lot of them had not gone through a redetermination process for quite some time. There were some efforts here and there to make some corrections, but for the most part, a lot of them stayed on, and in some cases for 2+ years. But starting in 2016, we put together a process where we would actually get caught up and get a correction to the redetermination process. And so as that kicked in, that's when you really started to see a decrease overall amongst the number of people who are on Medicaid. There are a number of reasons for that, but probably one of the more likely reasons is that a lot of those individuals at that point had been a couple years, and you know, their situations had changed, so they were able to drop off and hopefully move over to the exchange or some other form of coverage. And also, there were just individuals who, in some cases, maybe didn't respond to the redetermination letters that were sent out to them. If you move on to the next slide, this really focuses in on the other issue. What this slide is representing is the percentage of individuals who are enrolled in a CCO out of all of the individuals who are on Medicaid. And what you'll see over time, again, using that March of 2016 point as kind of an inflection point, prior to March 2016, you saw a little bit of up and down associated with that, but roughly it stayed in the 84, 85, 86% range, meaning that roughly that percentage of individuals were enrolled in a CCO. Since March of 2016, we've been seeing a decrease, a pretty steady decrease in that, so that at the last point that's within this particular chart, it's all the way down to about 81%. And I will say that even going beyond that time frame, the percentage has decreased a little bit more. So we're seeing overall decreases in the number of people on Medicaid. And within that population of Medicaid, we're seeing decreases in the number of people who are enrolled in a CCO.
What's the current number of total in Medicaid right now?
It's roughly around a million.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Quick question?
Yes.
Right. Are you going to explain what's... Okay, just check.
Yes.
Oops.
No, we. All right, so moving on to the next slide. And that is the big question. Why has that change been occurring? So in order to set that up, I want to talk a little bit about that fee-for-service population. The fee-for-service population is sitting right now roughly around 150,000 or so individuals. And as we mentioned earlier, it's been increasing. That fee-for-service population or open card population is made up of two basic categories of individuals. The larger proportion of those individuals are currently exempt for one reason or another from enrollment into a CCO, while the smaller number of them, and if you look at that chart up there, I'm talking, the smaller number is the light blue, the bigger number is the dark blue. The smaller number of individuals currently don't have any kind of exemption to enrollment into a CCO, but they just are not currently in a CCO. And that's one of the big issues that I want to talk about. And the point of having these two time intervals up here, which was March of 2016 and September of 2016, is that I wanted to show you that the number of people who are on open card with some sort of exemption has more or less been remaining steady over that time period, while the number of individuals who do not have an exemption to CCO enrollment has actually been increasing. So if you go on to the next slide, this just points to a number of the individuals, the types of individuals who have exemptions. Right now, people who have both Medicaid and Medicare, they have a choice in terms of how they want to enroll, and a lot of them are in a fee-for-service. People with tribal status.
Just a moment.
Sure.
Commissioner Hayden, did you have a clarification?
I do have a clarification on exemptions on the prior slide. Mm-hmm. You said that 107, 108 have exemptions. My understanding of that, those exemptions include state and federal exemptions, which the state could change the definition of some of those exemptions, correct? Not just federal exemptions.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, that is true, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, and on this next slide, on slide 5, that kind of goes through some of those. Some of the federal have to do with the people on Medicare, people with tribal status, but then there are also physical health enrollment exemptions that are granted by the state for various reasons. Yeah, next slide.
Can I ask a question on that one?
Yeah.
Would that include the Cowan population as well?
Right now, we are not including the Cowan population in this discussion. The Cowan population is a separate population, is not part of the Oregon Health Plan, and they're not currently enrollable into a CCO because of the way the payments work for them.
Go on.
So some of the things on the next slide, on slide 6, that we're doing right now to basically move people from having an exemption into being CCO members. People who are dual eligible will start moving into CCOs under the new 1115 waiver implementation. And we hope to have a lot of them in there by July of 2019. And basically the way we're going to do this is we're going to do it through what's known as passive enrollment. So those individuals who are dually eligible will be enrolled into a CCO, but then they will have a choice to disenroll themselves. People with third-party liability, which is another very large group of folks who are on fee-for-service, are going to be moved into CCOs starting in January of 2018. They were not originally included in direct enrollment into CCOs due to concerns around administration of third-party insurance, but we have worked with the CCOs on this topic over the past year, and they now feel comfortable with accepting that additional administrative burden, and we've worked on the rates with them, and we will be moving that group of individuals into CCOs starting in January. People with tribal status, there are a number of different things happening to actually help move those folks into CCOs, and some of which are outlined there in the bullets. But the thing to remember for both the dual eligibles, Medicaid, Medicare individuals, and tribals is that they will always have some sort of choice in terms of their enrollment, open card versus a CCO. So that's kind of an overview of that fee-for-service population. This next set of slides actually moves into some of the dynamics associated with enrollment and eligibility over time. I realize the slide itself is a little bit complicated, but what this is trying to illustrate is the fact that basically, between 1 month to the next, we have a number of different things going on. We have people who are adding to Medicaid. They're coming on to Medicaid. They haven't been on Medicaid recently or ever in some cases. We have people leaving Medicaid, hopefully for good reasons. they've got some other form of insurance to take care of their issues. And then we have also people who are in those fee-for-service open card categories or in a CCO. From month to month, they can also do some movement. They can stay in a CCO from month to month. They can move from a CCO into open card over the course of a month. The same is true for the fee-for-service individuals or open card individuals. They can stay in open card month to month. They can move over to a CCO over the course of a month. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, people can also drop. The basic dynamic that we're seeing in terms of that overall decrease in the number of Medicaid eligibles has to do with the numbers of people adding and dropping and what the net change is. When you have more people adding Medicaid than dropping, you're going to see growth in the Medicaid population.
I just need more clarification.
Sure.
By dropping, you mean these are people not who have called you and said, I don't need care anymore. These are people you've sent out a reassessment on and you haven't heard back from them in a lot of cases.
Chair Greenlick,
here's more about that as we go on.
That is one of the possibilities. Under the redetermination process, there are some people who may have dropped from Medicaid because they did not end up responding to the request for redetermination. There are also individuals who responded but no longer qualify for Medicaid.
Well, you have a table on that.
No, I don't have a table on that, but
talk about that when we're done.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So moving on to the next slide. So as I was saying earlier, basically what we've been seeing since March of 2016 is a dynamic where we have more people dropping than adding, and that's basically what's causing that overall decrease.
Can I just follow on that?
Sure.
The terminology. These aren't people that are dropping. These are people you are dropping. Is that right?
They are people, let's maybe another term to use is leaving they no longer qualify or...
No,
maybe,
you don't know that.
We don't know that.
Those are people that you are dropping because they haven't responded to you.
In some cases, some of them have responded and they no longer qualify.
Right. We'll talk about that.
So, maybe we should select a more generic term for that. Yep, next slide. So this next slide starts getting to really the issue between the proportion of people who are on open card versus CCOs. And that's really more of the inner dynamic. Rather than looking at people who are leaving the Oregon Health Plan versus coming onto the Oregon Health Plan, we're looking at the shifts between being a CCO member and moving over to fee-for-service or vice versa. And if we move to the next slide, basically what we've been seeing since March of 2016, and a little bit of this prior, is that we see a larger inflow of people into open card or fee-for-service status compared to CCOs. This table here basically has a before and after March 2016 average of several months. I think it's roughly about 8 months or so. And prior to March of 2016, we had a pretty good flow into fee-for-service, and the flow into the CCOs was more or less stagnant. It was roughly close to zero. But since that time, the flow into CCOs has increased dramatically. More than twice what it used to be, while the flow into CCO enrollment has decreased very dramatically. And again, that has to do with two things that are going on. One, people are no longer qualifying or they're not on the health plan any longer. Two, their status has changed in some way. And that starts getting to the real point that I want to make with you guys. On slide 11, basically, the key issue is to why people, there's a stronger flow into fee-for-service as opposed to CCO membership right now, has to do with a process called retroactivity. Retroactivity is associated with a break in coverage for individuals on Medicaid, and there are a number of reasons that it can happen. And what I have up here for you on the table is one particular example. But basically, anytime somebody has a break in enrollment for whatever the reason, and then they come back on to Medicaid, they can be retroactively put back onto Medicaid from the point at which they had applied or they had gotten their redetermination letter in, but they're always going to be placed into fee-for-service. They will never be retroactively enrolled into a CCO. And once that retroactivity occurs and they're placed in fee-for-service, they will spend some time in fee-for-service before the processes that need to occur will move them over into a CCO. This example here is one of the ones that's probably one of the worst experiences, I would say, for a member. But say you had somebody who had a renewal date for eligibility for Medicaid at the end of March. The person submits their renewal application late, but on time. OHA has already taken action, basically on 325, to implement a closure for this individual from Medicaid because they have to start initiating that a couple days, at least 5 days before the renewal date. The application, due to, say, backlog, finally does get processed in May of 2015. At that point, this person is retroactively enrolled into Medicaid all the way back to the point at which they lost it. And then the person, sometime after that time in May, will also end up getting enrolled into a CCO. What happens for that individual, if you go on to the next slide, is that that member actually submitted their application on time, but they end up being placed on the open card for a couple months. From our point of view, if you look at their eligibility on our Medicaid management information system, there's continuous eligibility for that person because they were retroactively placed back into Medicaid.
Proportion of the people you sent a renewal packet that didn't respond, that you dropped off coverage, came back on retroactively?
I don't have that percentage with me, but I can get
that. I have the numbers with you.
I do, but I don't have that exact percentage.
Well, let's start with the numerator. How many people had a...
I think some people had a... Well, this is impacting.
Retroactive.
Of the people, well, currently since March or so, we've been sending out roughly 80,000 or so redetermination letters a month.
Wow.
And of that proportion, there's been about 60%, and this varies somewhat depending on the region, roughly 60% of those individuals failed to respond to anything. The rest of them responded, and in some cases they may have responded late, meaning late in the cycle before their renewal date or even past their renewal date. In all cases, those individuals would end up being retroactively placed into Medicaid.
Proportion, what number came back? You don't want to talk about proportion?
I don't have the exact number.
You don't have the number up there, the people who were who had a break in coverage? I think you do.
I do not have that in front of me.
I'd be happy to follow up.
And it has varied from month to month.
None of these tables have that number of re-entry? The break-in, you have tables here on the break of coverage. How many people have had a break in coverage that were reinstated? I think that's on your graph.
So, Chair Greenlee, if one proxy for that would be to look from one month to the next if a person moved from a CCO over to fee-for-service, which would be an indication that they had gone through a retroactive process. And we're seeing roughly around 20,000 people or so in that situation on a month-to-month basis. So that would be a number of individuals that are experiencing that retroactivity on a month-to-month basis.
You send out 80,000 a year. 80,000
yes.
A month. Two-thirds of them don't respond. But roughly 20,000 a month end up coming back in retroactively.
Correct.
So a quarter of the ones you've dropped out come back in roughly from those numbers. Right?
Correct.
President Nosey,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm struggling to understand this. It seems like a... I'm not even sure how to formulate my question. How is it that someone can apply on time but still be late? Like, I'm really wrestling with slide 11 and 12 because this seems like a terrible inefficiency in our system where you apply on time, you're in a CCO, but then we kick you out and then we retroactively put you back on. I mean,
no,
this...
we retroactively put you in the open card.
Okay, oh, sorry. I'm really struggling with this whole thing. Like, this just seems... This just seems really bad.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, that I agree, and that's one of the points that we're going to end up addressing in one of these subsequent slides.
All right.
In terms of some of the things that OHA can do to make this more efficient process.
Yeah. So, kind of to add to Rep. Nose's comment, I want to know if 60% of the people have not responded of the 80,000. Letters. Do you have a breakdown of demographics who are not responding? Because I'm wondering, is it language barriers? Is it communication barrier? Like, what, you know, what could be some of the challenges, and how are you addressing those challenges?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Alonzo Leon, would it be possible for us to...
let's hold that question.
Yeah, we'd be happy to answer that question, but if we could move through this, it might at least help let you know where we are with this problem that we're bringing to
let's
you.
See that.
We don't, again, we don't have all the answers, but what we want to do is be clear about where we see the problems and what we're doing to fix them. So if we could just continue, I think we'll get some more information out, and that will be helpful.
Nelson, can you hold on?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No,
I'm trying to stop interrupting you, too.
It's a big... We understand. We understand the concerns.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. So moving on to slide 13. Here I wanted to illustrate to you how much retroactivity is actually occurring. And the way we can do this is to show you an example of how the overall number of people on Medicaid changes over time as you continually measure the same point in time. So what this table is basically illustrating is under the column that says initial caseload, for each one of these months illustrated here, this is showing what we show as the caseload when we look at it maybe 1 month after that month. So, and with the example of October of 2016, if I looked at that, if I looked to see how many people we had eligible in Medicaid in November of 2016, it would show about 978,000. If I wait 3 months and then again look at that same month of October, so I'm looking at it now in January of 2017, the number would be a little bit over 1 million. So it would have grown almost 5%. Basically, what you're seeing happen there is you're seeing a lot of retroactivity occurring so that as that month passes and people get some of their applications in late or they're processed late, by OHA, they are retroactively placed back into that month that they originally got their information in so that they can once again have continuous eligibility. But that's a really large number. It's roughly 40,000 or so individuals who are impacted by retroactivity. And all of those individuals are flowing into fee-for-service rather than a CCO. If you go to the next slide, one of the next questions you might have are the different parts of the Medicaid population that are more impacted by retroactivity, and the answer to that would be yes. All these columns that are under red are basically individuals who are qualifying under the ACA expansion in some way or another associated with their income, adults, some children, and so on, whereas all the columns that are under black are your more traditional Medicaid populations. These percentages, again, represent the volume of retroactivity that's occurring. So the red ones, you have fairly high retroactivity, but for the traditional Medicaid populations, you really don't see very much at all. So on the next slide, there are four major factors that are contributing to the retroactivity. People are submitting their renewal information late, either very late in the process or even after the deadline. People can also respond to requests for additional information, which sometimes ends up being necessary. And if they end up getting that information back to us late, it's going to be the same situation where the person will be disenrolled from Medicaid until that information gets in. And once it gets in, they would be retroactively placed back onto Medicaid. Another issue is, frankly, that OHA is late entering the information that gets into us. A lot over the past year, a lot of this information has been, in fact, the majority of the information has had to be entered in manually, and there is definitely a backlog. And if that backlog pushes individuals past the date of renewal, they end up being retroactively enrolled into Medicaid again. And there are at least three major contributors to the amount of retroactivity. One of them is that we're doing a lot of cleanup right now post-Cover Oregon. One of the reasons why we're having to enter all this information in manually, or we were having to enter the information in manually, is that there was a lot of missing information that was collected when people were placed into eligibility under Cover Oregon, and we're having to go back and make up and collect that information and plug it in anew. And there's a large volume also of those individuals. As we talked about at the very beginning, we had to delay redeterminations for some period of time, which just increased the volume that we had to take care of. This is also a new process for members. Previously, they dealt with case managers and such, which helped them help remind them, you know, to go through the process, get back on Medicaid. Now, in a lot of cases, this is left up to those individuals through mailing, and they had to get the mail, understand what it meant, and then go through the process of submitting the information.
How big was that application?
Pardon?
Yeah. How many pages is that application?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, I'm not sure.
It's honestly. 40 pages.
It's like this thick.
At least.
It's ridiculous.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, it's a 30-page paper application that we are, the good news is we're all but done with.
Okay.
So on the next slide, slide 16, there are four really big reasons, if it's not already clear, to be concerned about retroactivity. Number one is this is a lot of stress on the member, the Medicaid individual. When a person goes through retroactivity and is placed in fee-for-service, they can be in there anywhere from a couple weeks to several months, depending on the timing of when their application gets processed. It disrupts the member's care continuity. If the person was being managed under a coordinated care organization and all of a sudden they're placed into a fee-for-service situation, you know, their particular provider may or may not be accepting open card individuals, and it can cause a lot of stress from that point of view as well. This actually increases OHA's costs as well, because we are paying for any service that the individual receives on a fee-for-service basis. And it decreases the revenue for the coordinated care organizations, because they are not receiving any capitation for these individuals while they are open card. So, next slide. What is OHA doing about retroactivity? There are several reasons why we feel that retroactivity will decrease over time. One is that OHA is catching up on the last batch of these renewal applications that had to be manually entered into the one system, and this should reduce the backlog that we're currently experiencing, and there are some stats that we have that would indicate that that's true. One system for eligibility has also launched the applicant portal. So rather than having to respond to a mailing and filling out an application, because most of these individuals will have already been entered into one, they will be able to go through this portal and basically re-up with a much smaller amount of information their application for Medicaid to basically continue. And this will also cut down on the need to ask for additional information, because the portal itself will request that on a real-time basis. OHA is also reviewing, and I think this is particularly important to note, reviewing solutions to the disenrollment policies and programs associated with this. As noted earlier by Representative Nose, this seemed like there was a not very efficient way to handle some of these, so we're going back and looking at our internal processes, both in terms of what we've done to what we may have done initially to try and satisfy federal regulations or policies that we have, to see if there's any way to make that more efficient, plus looking to see if there's anything associated with the program of the eligibility system, the programming of that information system, that would allow us to move people through faster. And finally, we're looking to collaborate more closely with a coordinated care organization so that they could possibly work with their members to help facilitate creating reminders and various other activities to facilitate the individual maintaining continuity within Medicaid and enrollment within their CCO.
They've been asking that for about 2 years now. And how come you don't have up there one of the ability to simply put them back into the CCO they were in before?
Representative Chair, Chair Greenlick, sorry, could you, I'm sorry.
I was asking why wasn't one of your options just putting them back into the CCO they were in before?
Oh, you mean straight away rather than having to deal with any kind of retroactivity?
Yeah. Well, you still would have to deal with retroactivity.
But placing them into the CCO rather than placing them open card.
What he said.
Yeah.
Part of it has had to do, and that is something that we can explore. I know part of the issue related to that is that when the person is, during that period of time, they were not, when they're retroactively, they may have received some medical care, and to place the CCO as responsible for that medical care when they, for that period of time that maybe they weren't enrolled in a CCO.
Pay them the premium. Retroactively.
We would have to retroactively reimburse the capitation to the CCO as well. But I think that's one of the things that we can work to discuss with the CCOs.
Representative Melson?
Yes, I have a few points. Thank you, Chair, to make. I spent a good part of my career doing home visits to people because they had, quote, no insurance, and really what it was is they had lapsed off. So I've heard these stories so long I could scream. A number one, this is my experience, people, when you say a deadline is, the deadline's March 31st, they feel like if they get it on by March 31st, nothing's going to happen to them. You need to get out the message thing that if you want them to have it a certain time, say it's really February 28th and not March 31st, because people take that literally. The other thing I have found a lot is I would go to homes and I would find an application, you know, these redetermination benefits, and I'd be making a home visit and they'd say, what does this say? Because they don't speak the language very well. I worked with interpreters from all over the place, and they may have some English skills, but not enough English skills to read 30 pages of, you know, stuff. Another thing is I saw women that, a good chunk of my people were pregnant, and when you're pregnant, you don't get kicked off during your pregnancy. You go through the pregnancy, even though that's more than 6 months. So, A lot of people come onto the plan because they're pregnant. They do not understand somehow, maybe it's pregnancy brain, but they don't understand that they have to reapply. And so it's a really hard time to re-up all this stuff right after the birth of a baby. And I'm also wondering, people who are in the middle of a treatment, whether that's cancer or some other, you know, acute illness, it would seem to me that, like the protected, you know, pregnancy person, that maybe people who are in the middle of a treatment shouldn't get kicked off, you know, because they didn't understand how to put out their, you know, application in a timely manner. Those are some points that I've spent a lot of years dealing with, so that's my experience.
So, whose problem is this to solve? Is it a ways and means process because it's kind of budgetary and we're not giving enough resources to the agency to solve it? Or is it a policy thing, to your point 2 minutes ago about why don't we just let them stay on the CCO? I mean, this is maddening to me. Like, is it the policy committee's problem that we should fix this? The Ways and Means should address it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, we have two more slides and we have some proposed solutions that we'd like to discuss with you that may help lead that part of the conversation, but we look forward to engaging with you around those questions.
Okay.
And Dr. Saxton is here as well.
Representative Hack, you'll be first up.
Okay.
Fine.
Go ahead with the last.
Go ahead and do the last one, or are you going to go back to that one?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay. Which one are you on? That one?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
So, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. So, yeah, looking forward, basically the obvious solution is to figure out different ways, and there probably are a number of different ways and things that we can look at to try and reduce the amount of retroactivity that's occurring. And basically, if we're able to do that, that's going to help kind of solve the one issue that we have where we have more of the population flowing into open card rather than CCOs. And I think a number of the things that all of you, the members of the committee, have mentioned so far are things that we can go back and look at and see if we can figure out ways of implementing them either through processes and policies that we have and or through programming of the system. The other issue around the overall stability of the Medicaid population, where we've been seeing the decreases, currently our forecast is predicting that that's going to level out over time. And part of the reason why that prediction is out there is because, as we've talked about here in this meeting, we've been going through a correction process over the past 12 months or so, picking up and reviewing a lot of individuals who had not been reviewed or redetermined for quite some period of time. And we will be on a more regular schedule, pending any other kinds of federal things that might come get thrown at us. But we should be on a more regular schedule, both with the individuals and also with the process that's operating under the one system. So we expect the ins and outs associated with the Oregon Health Plan and people leaving or coming back on to kind of basically steady, so that they remain more flat over time, and we don't have as much volatility. So the final thing, so we do have several questions that we still need to address, one of which is, I don't know if I didn't really point it out because I was trying to move through the slides, but there does seem to be a higher percentage of retroactivity amongst children. We need to go back and explore and understand what's going on with that. Of those four main contributors to retroactivity, we weren't able to break it down to understand which one is the biggest, whether it's our backlog or people turning information in late. And so basically, the final point here is something I've already kind of stepped on earlier and, again, has been pointed out. I think there's a lot of different things that we can probably go back and explore internally to see what we can do to basically speed things up.
Okay. We have a voice, please. Let me react to this very specifically. One of the things that's, as you know, has been troubling me is what happens to those 80,000 people a year, a month, you send out renewal things for, and what happens to those? I think all this has done is heightened my concern about it, because the question is, when you send them out, are they still eligible? If they're still eligible, we want to find a way to get them back on, because it's very important for us to have them back on. If a relatively high proportion of them get eventually reinstated, it's an indication that they were still eligible. And the problem was getting that information and finding out that they were. Not that, oh, I've hit the lottery and I have $8 million now in the bank and I don't have to be eligible. I forgot to send you a letter telling you about it. I mean, I worry about how we find out before we drop those people off, and now it turns out throw them out of their CCO, even if they come back. I mean, well, I'm just frantic to know how much, what's happening to those people? Are they really eligible? And if they are, what can we do to get them back on coverage? Lynn, thank you for coming up.
Yeah, I just...
I didn't know you were still in your job after the early announcement.
Yeah, I'm Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. And
real director.
Chair Greenlick, part of the reason I wanted to come up is wanting to be sure we don't shoot the messenger, who is Dr. Collins, and I know that won't hurt. So we have a problem here. And I think this has been an excellent presentation of kind of what are the levers and what have we peeled back over the last few months, looking at what are the various parts of the system that aren't working well. And I share your concern that the process is dislocating people unnecessarily. And I think we are doing a very deep dive on all the elements, all the levers, and making sure that we address that problem. It's important to underscore here, and I would take you back to page 14, where you see where the problem is, which is with the expansion population. That's where the problem is, and again, it's disproportionate with children, which gives us part of the peeling back of how we get on top of this. However, there are two things that we have to go back and remember to be sure that we're understanding why this is happening. When the I was not here for Cover Oregon, but there was a deadline imposed in the Cover Oregon process where we had to stand up the one eligibility process, and I wasn't here for that choice either. And that's not to abrogate responsibility, it's simply to identify the sequence of decision making. But my understanding, as I've been informed by people who were here, is that one had to stand up on a specific date because of the litigation around the Cover Oregon process, and we effectively, in partnership with Deloitte and our partnership with DHS, stood up one. But it was very clear at the time that there would be two challenges in both executing the system after one was stood up to comply with the litigation timeframe. The first was that we made a conscious decision because of the enrollment process under Cover Oregon to re-enter data, to take those applications and make sure they were complete. And so that slowed us down dramatically, but as you know, and as we've reported in the 2015 session, we had to go through this process once one was stood up of hand entering data and getting the applications completed. And that process proved to be more onerous than I think anyone anticipated who made those decisions. But also, and we welcome you to come out and look at this process, we found a lot of incomplete and inaccurate applications. So what we erred on the side of was to slow down the redetermination process to give the optimal chance for people to be enrolled accurately, correctly, and in a timely manner. The consequence of that is, as Dr. Collins mentioned, is when we were doing redetermination, some of those applications had been there for a very long time, and they'd been there with information that was entered quickly and perhaps more frequently than any of us would like, inaccurately. So addresses, phone numbers, critical information that was done in the Cover Oregon process and then had to be peeled back and started over with the one eligibility system, I'm sure created some of this challenge for us. Now, secondly, the issue around so that's one issue. The other issue about this concern with not getting back to CCOs, we are coming to you today, not connecting more quickly to CCOs. We're coming to you today with saying we've just done kind of exhaustive work to be clear about the problem, and now the next step is to implement the corrections to the problem, and that work is underway. But the second concern here, and what Clyde Psyche and I have been working on and we'll be talking to you in other forums, is the one system that was stood up to comply with the Cover Oregon litigation was stood up in a very rudimentary form, right? It was a simple system that had been deployed in Kentucky, and the first phase of the stand-up anticipated 7 build-outs to get greater and greater sophistication with the population.
Well, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We have to end.
Okay, so we'll come back and talk to you about that.
I want to make a final point, though.
Sure.
And I've studied organizations a lot. I've been an organization consultant and organization theorist. I would submit this as a problem in organization culture. If it was a part of your culture to say every eligible person, every person in the state eligible for Medicaid will be on the Oregon Health Plan and will do everything possible to make sure that happens, where you would be going, you would be going in a different way. You would not send out 80,000 applications that have a 30-page application and say, boy, I hope everybody fills it out and gets back to us, and if they don't, they must not be eligible anymore. Oh, but if they show up later, we'll put them back on. You would be doing, you would not be throwing those things out in the blank to people who are functionally illiterate, who speak in a different language, who don't have an address anymore, who don't have a telephone, who don't know how to deal with it. You would be doing something very different in terms of if it was your success, your own measure of success, would be every eligible person in the state was on the Oregon Health Plan, it would be a different organizational culture. And it would be a different set of things to do.
So, Chair Greenlick, our culture is to ensure that people get access to Medicaid. And with the tools and the timing and the legal requirements we have been throwing everything we've got at doing that well and doing it with support from community assisters, for example, who do break down the language barriers and do convene with members to ensure they have access. And could we do a better job of educating and working with the population to ensure they have access to this? Yes, and I think it's documented on slide 14. With the population we've been working with for decades, we do a very good job. The numbers support that. We have a challenge in our three-year-old system with our current limits, which we are addressing, correcting, and improving, and problem-solving to overcome. We will develop the cultural response you're suggesting. Are we where we need to be right now? No, we are not. Were we given the tools necessary to be where we need to be right now? No, we did. We're not. Did we have to move extremely quickly in order to meet all the parameters that have been set for the program at the federal and state level and in the courts? We did. I would tell you we can do better, and we will.
I'm not saying it's an easy job. I understand it's not.
I know.
I understand it's a tough job.
Yeah.
Let's keep talking about this.
Are we going to reschedule, hear more about this?
Yeah, I think it would be really good to put it back on the agenda.
Okay, good.
No, not Friday.
Okay. Well, well, we have some bills.
Hayden,
some of this information
will fit.
Okay, we're happy to come back as often as you want. I also would encourage any of you who'd like to come look at what the process currently requires. We'd be happy to provide those tours.
I can hear that the director at one time, your predecessor, promised that that 30-page application would be down to 8 pages in 3 months. That hasn't quite happened yet. President Hayden, you want the last word?
Thank you for working on it. This has been something that I've been passionate about for 2 years. Yep. I'm glad it's coming to light, and it's going to be very difficult to fix, but we need to stay tuned to it.
I hope we weren't too mean to the messenger.
Oh, no.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you very much. How much work John has done to peel this back very quickly. I mean, getting to, it's not just a, our goal is never to just come and give you information without understanding the information and being able to at least tell you what we view as next steps. And so we appreciate your patience as we work on this. We want to be transparent with you. We want to tell you about the challenges we're facing and how we're planning to proceed. So
I appreciate that. With that, I'll close the informational hearing. We are adjourned. Informational hearing. We are adjourned.